brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I didn't want everything to come from the sideline, but I also wanted enough structure to help them get through some tough times. They couldn't do it on their own.
Toby Frazier is the color analyst for Jacksonville University men's and women's basketball. He was previously the head boys basketball coach at his alma mater, Paxson High School in Jacksonville, Florida, from 2013 to 2021. His teams at Paxson won back-to-back district and regional championships while making Final Four appearances in 2019 and 2020. Toby had 9 players that went on to play college basketball, and he coached 2020's Florida's Mr. Basketball, Isaiah Adams. Toby started his coaching career at NAIA Edward Waters College in 2004, and then went on to be an assistant coach at various high schools from 2005 to 2013. As a player, Toby was a 5-year varsity starter and a high major recruit in 1997. He was a Prop 48 at Georgia Southern University, then transferred to Kilgore College, before finishing his career at Jacksonville University from 2000 to 2002, playing for Hall of Fame coach Hugh Durham.
Hey Hoopheads, this February our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $1,250 off the Dr. Dish Rebel Plus. You can also subscribe to their 30-day free daily motivational email series for coaches. Check out their new goal setting feature at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT Plus models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Ted Hotelling, head men's basketball coach at the University of New Haven, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Toby Frazier, the color analyst for Jacksonville University men's and women's basketball.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Toby Frazier, currently the color analyst for Jacksonville University men's and women's basketball, former coach at both the high school and college levels. Toby, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, thank you for having me, guys.
Absolutely excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball life. Want to go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball, what you remember from an early age.
So my first experience was around 5 years old. Luckily for me, my parents, the house that they decided to move into when they moved into a new neighborhood was a street over from the park. So I can't remember this, but from what I'm told from neighborhood people and family members, that I was leaving the house on my own at 5 years old, going to the park by myself. So discovered the game there, just trying to hang out with other kids, and we would play basketball every day. And my life changed one day around 8 years old, where we had two sides in my park. We had the kids side, and then you had the grown up side. Side by side, full courts. And one day, the older guys, they only had 9. So I was the better out of the kids in my age group. So one of the guys said, hey, he could play with us until somebody else shows up. So, you know, it was my first audition, and I didn't want to mess it up. And I played well, just didn't turn the ball over. Of course, I didn't take a shot. You weren't allowed to take shots, you know, as a kid at that age. But the older guys kind of accepted me in. And from there, it just took off. You know, continued to play with the older guys, always played with the older guys. One of the guys took a liking to me. He was the best player in our neighborhood. He became a high school phenom, one of the best point guards that we've ever had in Jacksonville, a guy by the name of Mark Felton. So Mark would take me to the high school, it was Paxson High School, which I end up going to and where I end up coaching. He would take me with him in the summer and I would play pickup with the high school kids. And from there, you know, I was one of the guys, continued to play with the big boys, ended up playing my first regulation basketball game at 11 in a police athletic league. And from there, I was selected to play on the travel team. And we ended up playing in a national tournament. PAL was the thing back then in Jacksonville, more so than AAU was. From there, ended up being one of the better players in the PAL league. After that, I played a year of AAU with my age group. During that time, I was fortunate enough to be introduced to the head coach at Edward Waters College, the NAIA school here in Jacksonville. And he took me under his wing and he introduced me to everybody that he knew in Jacksonville in the basketball world. But he ended up introducing me to this guy named Jim LaPointe, who was the varsity coach at a private school in Jacksonville. And after seeing me play pickup, the guy's like, hey, he can play varsity for me next year as an eighth grader. And I was blown away. You know, I'm like, varsity, like, you can't do that. He was like, yeah, the school is K through 12. We have a varsity team. You can play varsity. I'm the coach. So I ended up playing varsity as an eighth grader, started as an eighth grader playing varsity, did very well. From that point on, I moved on. I did a year at that school, Southern Baptist Academy, went to Paxson High School, and my high school career began. And, you know, did some good stuff in high school, was regarded as one of the best point guards in the Southeast. Went to ABCD Adidas camp with the group with Tracy McGrady, Keon Dooling, Lamar Odom was there at the time, Udonis Haslam. You know, just from that point on, you know, just the start of it all, I would say is the my background from starting in the park and meeting the older guys and having those older guys just take me by the hand and welcome me in. It just kind of guided me on that path, you know, that I ended up on.
Absolutely. All right. So I want to get to your high school career and some of those experiences that you talked about at ABCD and that kind of thing. But I want to go back to two points that you made as you were talking there that kind of stuck with me. And one is something that we talk about with a lot of people that maybe are a little bit in the age bracket closer to mine as opposed to the age bracket of somebody who might be in their 20s today or their teens, somebody who grew up in a different era of basketball. And obviously you mentioned playing with the Police Athletic League, you mentioned playing a season of AAU, but the majority of your basketball, it sounds like, was learned at the park, on the playground, playing with older guys. And that's the way I grew up. And clearly it's different from the way that kids grow up in the game today. Clearly it's different from the way that, as you were coaching at the high school level just a couple of years ago, different from the way that your players came up in the game. So when you think about that, and I always think this is just an interesting question to kind of ponder and get people's opinions on, how do you think about the way that you grew up in the game and how it helped you versus the way that kids grow up in the game today, where you're kind of playing with your own age group? And obviously there's more access to gyms, there's more access probably to better coaching and resources and all those things. But I still feel like kids miss out on some of that mentorship and some of that sort of learning the old man tricks from people that you're learning and playing with on the playground. So just give me your perspective on sort of the old way that basketball was when you were a kid versus the way it is now for youth players coming up.
Well, I think the main thing is, Mike, is to me, the education that is missing. So I remember being 11 years old and Otis Smith, the old NBA player, played at for the Orlando Magic, Golden State Warriors back in the day. I had a chance to spend time with Otis. So Otis taught me how to walk in the gym and warm up. He's like, look, you don't walk in the gym and shoot free throws. You start at the basket. You start with the mic and drill. Then you take a step back. Then you end up at the free throw line. You know, I was introduced to guys that played overseas They tell you how to tie your shoes up, how to bring a bag to the gym, bring extra t-shirts so you don't stay soaking wet. Then you learn how to earn your way, because you're playing on the court with older guys. You can't shoot all the shots. So it makes you have to, you know, you have to move without the basketball. You have to screen. You have to be focused on defense, because you don't know if they're going to continue to let you to play, let you play with them. So you're always under evaluation and you want to prove a point, which in turn makes you better as a player. And then the biggest thing I think that kids miss today, that I feel like the way I grew up, was playing in the park and playing pickup with older guys. You don't want to lose because you have five or six guys that have nets. So if we lose, that's like four or five games that we may have to sit if we don't win. So the intensity level is high, and there's more value put on the games, because if we don't win, nobody wants to sit. So it's a lot more intense. The shot selection is criticized a lot more. You can't take a bad shot when we're trying to win, you know. And I think now, you know, with AAU tournaments, there's a game minimum. No matter what happens, we guarantee four games. Win or lose, we're going to play till Sunday. When I was playing AAU basketball, if you didn't win Friday and first thing Saturday, we were headed home Saturday afternoon. You know, there were no minimum game guarantees. And I think one thing that's being lost today is the value in winning, and kids are more caught up now in to showcasing what they can do. Well, the college coach is going to always want to win because his salary is tied to wins and losses. You know, and I think that's the gap that we're seeing today, where kids are, I want to showcase, I'm trying to make it to the league, I'm trying to make it overseas. And the high school and the college coaches are, hey, we're trying to win. We're trying to have a successful program. So I think that's the biggest thing. You learn protocol, you learn respect from the older guys, and you actually learn how to play the right way.
How did you try to bridge that gap as a high school coach? So you see that that's something that kids are missing, that mentorship, that leadership, that passing down of knowledge. So as yourself, when you're coaching both as an assistant and as a head coach at the high school level, what are some of the things that you're doing, whether it's just through conversations or the way you design your practices or drills? What could you point to as far as things that you did to try to help bridge that gap that we're talking about?
Well, what I did was what I saw my high school coach do. So my high school coach was a former college player at Jacksonville University prior to becoming a high school coach in our area. And when I was in high school, our gym was the spot for the older guys, the overseas guys, the college guys to play pickup in the summertime. So once I became a head coach, I made sure that any local guys that were playing overseas, that was playing college ball, that was home for the summer, you had to come to Paxton to play pickup with my kids, because I wanted them to get pushed around. I wanted them to see the physicality of the next level. I wanted them to see a better brand of basketball, or how Division I players play, or how college players play, or overseas guys, how they play. So I tried to recreate that environment that my high school coach created for me. And then we did stuff like in the summertime, we would make the kids play 21. We would split up three baskets, put three kids at a basket, and make them play 21, make them have to fight, rebound, try to score on one another. We would play king of the court for bragging rights. I just tried to do everything I could to recreate that environment of competitiveness. And we had situations where we just played practice days, where we just played pickup. Like, we literally, it was during the season, and I would tell the kids, hey, we're going to pick first two guys that make it, our captains, and then you guys pick teams. And two things I wanted to accomplish. I wanted the kids that got picked last, I wanted them to see that it's not just me that think what I think of their game. Their peers also don't think too much of their game because they get picked last by them, because they're trying to win at that point. So you're killing, you know, a lot of birds with this stone by doing it this way. But to answer your question, I just try to recreate my childhood and bring it into my personal high school situation when I was coaching.
Yeah, well said. And I think that's something that if you can do that, I love the idea of bringing in guys to participate in your open gyms that can give some of that mentorship that you talked about. And man, having kids play 21, I'm not sure that kids today even know what 21 is in a lot of places. It's crazy when I think about how much time I played 21 in my driveway, or we used to have a court in the neighborhood that
had these steel rims that you could go and play on these 8.5 foot rims. Then you'd be trying to dunk on everybody and getting the follow up dunks off the miss. And can remember doing that from the time I was pretty young and just got a lot of good memories at 21. And it's funny that kids today, I don't think they even know or understand what it is. So I'm sure you had to teach them what that game was all about. It's funny just how, again, how things sort of turn and go through cycle, you know, go through cycles. And it's awesome when you can bring back something that was good for you and obviously is good for kids developing their game and toughness and all the things that go along with the game of 21. But let's talk a little bit about your experience as a high school player. First thing I want to touch on is you playing on the high school varsity as an eighth grader. So I think one of the things that it feels like today, it's maybe not as big of a deal as it was probably back when you were playing or when I was playing, where how'd you fit in as an eighth grader? Not so much as a player, obviously as a player, if you have the ability to do that, great. But then there's also this whole sort of off the court and in practice and in the locker room where, hey, we got seniors and now here's this eighth grader. That's a part of it. So what do you remember about trying to fit in, not so much as a basketball player, but more just as a human being trying to find your place on that team?
Well, first off, you know, I was blessed. God actually birthed me up as a point guard. So I haven't had too many problems in my life with basketball because I just always had a joy for passing the ball.
There you go.
So nobody has any issues with the guy that loves to pass the ball all the time. My teammates at that time, I was welcomed in with open arms. They were some very, very nice guys. I remember the senior on that team, a guy by the name of Isaac Wilbur. He could flat out shoot the basketball, very soft-spoken, had a real old soul, was a silent leader. He was the one that I was intimidated by the most for obvious reasons. He was the best player on the team, and he was a senior. And he didn't say too much to me initially. And then I come to learn that that's just his personality. He didn't mean anything by it. But the thing that what shocked me the most was I got a lot of grief from the opposing team's fans and coaches because there was a lot of fanfare around me. It's like, hey, you know, Southern Baptist has his eighth grade kid. They have his eighth grade kid. So when I would go in the games, you know, I've had some opposing coaches actually say, oh, he's not that good. That kid should be playing middle school. And so I was kind of taken back by that because being a kid, you just think that everybody is for you and everybody just enjoys to see you play. So that was my first taste of the real world. Like, nah, you're on the other side. You're on the other team. We don't care how good they say you're supposed to be. You know, we're going to go at you. So. Overall, it was a great experience, though. I can't say there were any negatives from within the team, within the school. A great basketball experience for me. I started every game and I just about played every game. So, you know, great game experience and coaching experience. The coach was a great guy. Have lost contact with that guy. I would love to find him. I lost contact with him. Didn't see him after that year at all.
Passing the ball makes all the difference, Toby.
Yes.
I mean, yeah. You and I both know, and I've had this conversation with numerous people on the podcast and off the podcast. There's some people that you get in a pickup game with or you play on a team with, and you instantly know after like 30 seconds, I never want to play with this dude again because they're just dribbling between their legs 47 times, and then you know they're going to hoist it up, and they're only going to pass as a last resort.
James Harden.
There you go. Versus you have somebody who passes the ball and is unselfish and is thinking about getting their teammate the best possible opportunity. And it's just such a contrast. And so I think if you can be a player, and any players who are out there listening, obviously coaches know this, but any players out there listening, if you can become a person who loves to pass the ball, man, you find so many more opportunities. If you're a guy that can pass the ball and you have a high IQ, it makes all the difference.
And you know, I'll say this about that. What stimulated me as a player, especially as a high school player, when you make a good pass, everybody compliments you. Your teammates compliment you. People in the stands say good pass. When you make a shot, you feel good. Your mom may feel good, but very rarely do people outside of your circle, like your family circle, say good shot. But if you make a good pass, you know, especially if it's a good no look, something, you know, you see it before it happened, 5 seconds before it happens, everybody says good pass. Even if you can get opposing parents to say, man, that was a good pass.
Yep. And it's so much fun to play on a team or coach a team when the ball moves. And man, it makes such a difference when you, whether you're playing on a team, whether you're coaching a team, if you have players who are unselfish and are willing to pass the ball, it just makes the game so much easier.
No, I agree. I totally agree.
All right. Tell me a little bit about your experience at ABCD playing with some of the guys and the big names that you mentioned. Now, obviously, that's another thing that's gone away. You don't have the five-star, the ABCD in the same way that they had it back in the day. So tell me a little bit about that experience.
Now, I'll tell you, Mike, I was so grateful for that opportunity. I hand wrote Sonny Vaccaro a letter on like the little hotel stationery, just thanking him. Like I wrote it, I kept it in my pocket, and I saw him on the elevator. And I was like, Mr. Vaccaro, and I handed it to him. I just was so grateful for the opportunity. And at the time, you got to understand, we are all just high school kids. We don't know that this is going to be T-Mac. We don't know that this is going to be Lamar Odom. I didn't know, you know, we had a group called the Florida Boys. Me, Keon Dooling, Udonis Haslam, Myron Anthony, Teddy DuPay, Brent Wright, Sib Wright. So we were the Florida Boys, and we just were trying to represent for Florida. And we just, everybody would watch each other's games and be supportive of each other. And then in hindsight, when you look back and you're like, man, that dude ended up being an all-star. That dude ended up being a Hall of Famer. Like, you know, the Kenny Smith was just hanging around. Kenny the Jet was just hanging around. Our camp counselors at the time, funny story. The reason why I got a tattoo, Chauncey Billups was one of our counselors. So the college guys, I think Chauncey Billups, I would think one of the O'Bannon brothers, I can't remember if it was Charles, I think the younger brother, Charles.
Okay.
They would, the counselors late at night, they would play pickup and George Carl from the NBA, I can't remember where he was coaching at the time, he would take them through stuff like drills and NBA stuff. But Chauncey Billups had this tattoo with this lion or a tiger or something, and it said King of the Jungle. And I saw that. I was like, I got to get a tattoo. I got to get a tattoo. Like, it just was, it was basketball heaven, man. Like, and all the coaches around, all the Division I coaches hanging around in the lobby of the hotel, you know, eating, talking, you go play games. It just was an awesome experience. Like, it was the ultimate basketball experience to see front row. You see Mike Krzyzewski. You see Roy Williams. You see Billy Donovan. You see all these guys, and you're like, man, they're here just to watch us play basketball. Amazing experience.
Tell me a little bit about your recruitment, your college decision, what that was like, what you remember about that phase of life.
So probably the most disappointing as well as the most gratifying time of my life was around making a college decision. So I played my way into having Wake Forest, Alabama, and Florida State give me house visits. And on cloud nine, love Florida State, love Alabama, grew up watching Hollywood Robinson, chew the bubble gum, you know, blowing the big bubbles, big hot Alabama fan. Coach Odom was at Wake Forest at the time. I love Randolph Childress. So for me, it was a great situation to be in with these three schools. And when it was all said and done, I was a non-qualifier. And I can remember it like it was yesterday. I was supposed to take my visit to, I had home visits from everybody. I was supposed to take a visit to Alabama on this particular weekend. And I'm talking to Coach Bob Marlin, who's was assistant coach at the time. And he's like, tickets should be there by Wednesday. We're sending it FedEx. So Wednesday comes, no ticket. Thursday afternoon, no ticket. So Thursday night, Coach Marlin calls and he's like, hey, man, I got bad news. And I'm like, what's up, Coach? He said, we were also recruiting a kid out of Savannah that plays the point. He was supposed to visit South Florida this weekend. You were supposed to come here. He canceled his visit and committed to us. And he's a qualifier. You haven't qualified yet. And man, it was devastating. Same situation with, Wake Forest. They end up signing, a guy that was on my team, James Griffin at Wake Forest. He and I were on teams at ABCD. Pat Kennedy ended up getting fired at Florida State at the end of the year. I still didn't have a test score, so it didn't make a difference. Minnesota came in late and they were entertaining trying to prop me, but they just, the guy called a couple times, ended up calling anymore. So how I end up at, I ended up signing with Georgia Southern University. At the time, the head coach at Georgia Southern was Greg Polinsky. He's an assistant at Tennessee now with Rick Barnes. He was on a previous staff with Dave Hobbs at Alabama that was recruiting me. And Alabama basically told him, Coach Hobbs basically told him, hey, we had this kid in Jacksonville. He's not going to qualify. You know, see if you can make a play on him. So they came in and they wanted to prop me. My mom, when she got a whiff of what was going on, she didn't want me to do anything. She was like, you know, my old school mom. She was like, you didn't do what you're supposed to do. You know, you're not doing anything that's going to cover up the fact that you didn't do it. You're not going to prep school. You're not going to junior college. She was livid. She was like, I can't believe, you know, all of these people giving you all this attention, burning their gas and all this stuff. So, Georgia Southern was what it was. And it just wasn't, I love the school. Like, I love the school. Like, I love my teammates being a student. Just, it was the ultimate experience, but the basketball was just not what I was used to. Like, you know, I went, you know, immature things. I grew up being an Adidas kid. I'm getting Adidas packages in the mail, you know, sweatsuit shoes, and they were wearing Russell uniforms. Like, we wear Russell uniform with Nike shoes. So I'm like, nah, man, I can't. It just never sat well. And I sat out that year. I got stronger, got better. And then the year that my second year after sitting out, we played Florida at Florida. We put Florida on the schedule for me to come back home. Jacksonville is like an hour from Gainesville. And I played about 8 minutes and I had all these people at the game. And, I played two more games. The last out of those two, I think I played maybe 3 minutes and just bad communication between me and coach. I couldn't get any feedback. I just felt like I was on the island and it was a bit immaturity on my part. So I decided, I went in the office like a man. I said, hey coach, this is not working for me. I'm leaving. When I go home for Christmas, I won't be back. And he kind of tried to talk me out of it. That didn't work. I already had my mind made up. And I ended up transferring to Kilgore College in Kilgore, Texas, junior college.
What was the JUCO experience like?
JUCO experience was the best experience, basketball experience that I had. And I say that, you know, specifically basketball experience because the living situation wasn't the best. The cafeteria wasn't the best. The town that we were in wasn't necessarily the most exciting place. But from a basketball standpoint, I grew up as a man. You're out there in Texas. I don't know anybody, you know, and every night in junior college basketball, you're playing against some guy that you never heard of and he can flat out play. And it's like we were trying to get out of prison the way we were playing against each other. It's like, man, everybody, you got to get out. Like, this is my last chance. And tonight that I'm playing against you may be the night that the coach is here recruiting me to give me a last look. So it was cutthroat every single night. And I left that situation feeling like junior college basketball is some of the most underrated basketball in the country. Like, it's some guys that just in some bad situations, some unfortunate situations that can flat out play all over the country.
Then you get a chance to come home to Jacksonville.
Yeah. So funny story about Jacksonville. When I'm leaving Kilgore, my teammate, so we had a, when I transferred to Kilgore at Christmas, we had two guys on that team that I was when I was sitting out. They went to UNLV. Trevor Diggs, Sylvester Dotson, they went to UNLV. So Bill Bano's the coach at the time. So Bano comes back the following year and he gets my shooting guard, Jermaine Lewis. So they sent the assistant coach and then Bano came to seal the deal and we're playing pickup that day and I'm killing it. I'm killing it, man. I'm just doing what I do, running the show, getting guys looks, talking, defending the ball. And Bano's like, "Hey man, where are you going to school?" And I said, I'm going back home. And I said, I actually called them. I called Jacksonville University and asked them, did they need a point guard? They didn't recruit me. I made a phone call. I had a high school friend that was playing on the team at the time. I called them and it was like, "Hey, I want to come back home." And, you know, they came out and watched me play a couple of times. They're like, "Yeah, you can come back home." But that particular day, Bano was like, you can't. He was like, "You can't go. You're too good. You can't go back to Jacksonville." And I'm like, I just was over the whole, I was over it. Like, you get older, you start to mature, you start to see things for what they are. You know, I had Louisiana Tech, South Florida, Northeastern, Charlton Young, who's the assistant at Missouri. He was the head coach at Northeastern at the time. And I just was like, you know, I was kind of over it. I was entertaining South Florida because it was in Florida, but my man, who's the analyst now for ESPN, Seth Greenberg, he told me to my face, he was like, I like you, I'll sign you, but you won't start. He's like, no matter what you do, you won't start for me. And I was like, really? So I was like, I don't know if this was some type of challenge. He was, but I was over the whole trying to prove myself. So I'm like, he's the head coach. He's saying you're not going to start. I'm like, I'm not. And it wasn't a cop out. I just was over the whole, I was a high major recruit. I did the ABCD thing. I had respect for my peers. My sister had just had my nephew. My mom had only seen me play like twice in 2 years. I was like, I was just ready to go home. You know, I just was ready to go home. And my junior college coach gave me the best advice. He asked me, he said, "When it's all said and done, where would you want to live?" He said, "Even if you went to the league, where would you want to live?" And I said, "Jacksonville." He said, "You need to go back to Jacksonville." He said, "You need to go start building your relationships, letting people know you're back around." He said, it's going to help you in the long run. And he was absolutely right about that.
What were you thinking about in terms of a career? Was that something that you were considering? Were you talking about coaching at this point, or where were you at in that respect?
You know, in that regard, Mike, is I was lost. Like, I've always been a diehard basketball kid. It was always your peers are telling you, your family members are telling you, you have uncles. You know, I had an uncle, you know, he's always saying, "Hey, man, I want a Maserati. When you make it, I want a Maserati." You know, so it's just always basketball. Like, it was so much basketball that I felt like I was cheated out a lot of my childhood because nobody ever said, "Hey, what else do you want to do? Like, what other talents do you have? Is there anything else? Basketball is going to stop one day." There was this assumption that I was just going to play basketball, and I kind of fed into it. So I had a period of time where when I got out of college, you know, you're speaking of that time, even when I got out of college, I kind of wandered for a couple of years because I wasn't sure. I had never tried to tap into any other, you know, sector or career, or, you know, I had this wild dream in college of wanting to be a marriage counselor because I used to help all my teammates with their relationship problems. So my nickname was Dr. Phil.
Nice.
And, you know, I just used to, you know, try to help them. "Hey, man, look, you need to do this. You can't do that. You need to tell her this. You know, she probably saying this." You know, so outside of that, I never thought about anything else.
So when does coaching get on your radar? When do you start to look at it and say, "Okay, like, the game has been such a huge part of my life. How do I keep the game centered in my life?" When did you get to coaching?
So I got to coaching when I did a couple rounds with some ABA basketball, had an opportunity to go play in England, which was cut short by the car accident that I was in. And, you know, I just, I asked myself at that point, I was like, do you really want to keep doing what you're doing with no guarantee? Because I was a go hard guy, like no work ethic issues. I'm up at 6 a.m. I'm running, I'm doing weights, I'm doing all this stuff independent. Like I didn't need a trainer and all that kind of stuff. So once I decided that, you know, I kind of was done with playing, I was satisfied with playing, I felt like I had a debt that I owed to the community. So, so many older guys that helped me along the way, gave me so much good information, spent time with me, taught me the game, taught me how to play the right way, you know, how to be a good person, how to be a good teammate. I just felt like I deserve, the community deserved for me to give something back. So, of course, with my last stop being, you know, kind of like college, that was the first, you know, push was like, hey, man, you need to try to get on a college staff. So I went to the local NAIA we have here, which I was familiar with the coaching staff because they are full of guys that I've been around for a while. And I volunteered over there for a couple of years. And my experience from coaching in college turned me to high school because some of the players were coming into college so deficient. And I was like, you know, I'd rather be on the level to help guys get to this level so they'll be better, they can survive more, or they'll be better ready for this level versus getting guys in college and trying to change and mold them and, you know, get stuff out of their game or change their attitude. I was like, you know what, I'd rather catch them when they're younger. So let me go to the high school level.
What did you learn during your time as an assistant coach at the high school level that you feel like eventually helped you when you took over and became a head coach? What were the lessons that you learned as an assistant that really helped you to thrive as a head coach when you finally got that opportunity?
You know, early on as an assistant coach, it was tough because you always have those moments where, you know, you feel like you have the better idea. So what I learned was, and this is what I tell young guys now, you want to be the type of assistant coach that you would want to have. So what I learned from, and I actually learned this just from out of frustration, you know, I would think we should be doing this in practice and we're not doing this. And so I think we should be running this in the game and we're not running it. I was like, you know, your job is to support this guy, like just support him, coach the kids, keep the kids upbeat and try to figure out how can you make his life easier. Rather it be you washing the uniforms tonight, rather it be you doing pregame meal, you know, what taking kids home, whatever you could do. So I changed my mindset to more of a servant mindset versus from a coaching mindset. Because you can always agree to disagree with basketball stuff, philosophies, what plays we should be running, who should be in the game, all of that type of stuff. And what I wanted was I wanted a peace of mind. When I became a head coach, I didn't want to be looking over my shoulder because I felt like I treated all of my head coaches when I was assistant coach. I felt like I did right by them. So if I see one of my assistant coaches having a conversation with a parent, I don't really feel a certain type of way because I didn't have those sidebar conversations against my head coaches when I was an assistant coach. So, you know, I learned the biggest lesson that I learned through some of my basketball frustrations was, hey, man, it's not about you. At the end of the day, it's his team. You're his assistant. Support him and serve him to make his life easier.
That loyalty piece, I think, is something that we've had a lot of coaches, both that are assistant coaches and head coaches, talk about where, just like you said, you have to present a united front. You have to, even though you might disagree behind closed doors with your head coach as an assistant, when you step out into the public eye, everybody's got to be on the same page. And I think that's a case where you want somebody who's going to be loyal. You want somebody who, as you said, has that servant mindset where they're going to do what it takes to be able to support their head coach and to be able to support their program and support their players. And I think that's a huge, huge piece of it. As you think about that time while you're working as an assistant coach, what were some of the things that you did to grow as a coach, where did you go to learn the game? Were you studying a lot of film? Were you reading books? Were you talking to mentors? Were you doing all those things? Just how did you try to improve your craft during that time while you were an assistant?
So during that time, you know, most of the time during my tenure as an assistant coach at Jacksonville, Clifford Warren was the head coach at Jacksonville University. He's now an assistant at SMU. So he and I became close when he got the job here at JU. And I use him a lot. You know, I would call him, hey, coach, you know, how do you guys defend the block-to-block screen? Coach, you know, how do you guys decide how you're going to defend the ball screen? Coach, you know, what do you guys do, you know, to make sure that practice is upbeat? Or what do you guys do when guys are struggling? So he was a big source. He, as well as my junior college coach, Scott Schumacher, who's at Blaine College right now, I would reach out to Coach Shu for any drama issue. Junior college coaches, they deal with a lot of drama. They deal with a whole lot of drama. So if we had any type of drama going on, parents or kids beefing with each other, I would call Coach Shu and say, hey, coach, this is the situation. You know, what, you know, how do you handle it? How should we attack it? So I always try to improve. Of course, you go to coaches' clinics here and there. You know, you stay online, you watch games, you watch the tournament, especially you see teams that you usually don't see a lot. During that time, you know, live stream and ESPN Plus and all that stuff wasn't really around. So, you know, you had to physically go, you know, go to college games, go to college practices, reach out to your resources online just to ask questions. And, you know, I was never shy about that stuff because I'm trying to help my kids. So never shy about asking for something that is going to benefit my kids.
And obviously over time, you improve as a coach, you fine tune your craft, and eventually you get an opportunity to be a head coach. And in a rather unique situation, you get an opportunity to be a head coach at your alma mater. So tell us a little bit about the process of how that came to be.
So, you know, I don't know. It was in 2013. And I think I remember going to, I was still an assistant coach at the time. And I remember we played in a summer league event with Paxson. And then maybe like a couple weeks later, the guy quit who was coaching. And when I found out the job came open, you know, I was like, I gotta have it. Like, I gotta get the job because, you know, that was the only place really, honestly, that I would want to be a head coach in Jacksonville. If I didn't want to be a head coach at any other high school, I could stay being assistant and just helping kids and, you know, helping other kids around the city at different schools, without having to be tied down. But, when it came open, got resume ready, started making phone calls, started rallying up the alumni. And, you know, rightfully so, when I finally got a chance to interview, the athletic director said, I've gotten over 100 phone calls saying we can't hire anybody but you for this job. You know, and that made me feel good because, you know, at the career that I had as a high school player, at Paxson just was, you know, I had a good reputation. People liked seeing me play. I was successful. You know, I was good at what I did as far as running the point and, you know, just had a good high school career. I always kept my nose clean, always been positive, you know, so, you know, an opportunity presented itself, you know, I went after it and I applied for other jobs during the years, but the Paxson interview was my first interview that I got. The other jobs I applied for, I didn't even get an interview.
Well, you did a lot of things right there to try to get yourself in the door. And obviously, I think anybody who coaches at their alma mater, I think there's a special feel to that, right? You have just one more strong connection to that job and you feel a sense of pride of having gone through the program and wanting to get it to reach the heights that you know that it's capable of. And so I think when you coach at your alma mater, it's always a special thing.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. an emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe Stecision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
When you think back to that first year as the head coach, what was the biggest adjustment, surprise, thing that maybe was different as a head coach than what you anticipated it was going to be before you became a head coach?
It was all of the non-basketball stuff. So it was the making sure that we have somebody to work concession stand, making sure that your bus is ordered for road games, making sure that we have fundraisers in place. It was a lot of things in place. So, you know, I'll say this, Mike, and you guys don't fall out your chair. My first 2 years as a head coach, I didn't have keys to the gym.
Wow.
That's crazy. So, yeah, there was some things that were done by the previous regime, you know, that the administrators felt like they didn't know who had keys. So they wanted to, you know, and I'm thinking like, well, I'm the basketball coach. You know, at least I should have them.
Right. You know?
So I did that for 2 years, and I only did that because that was my school. But, you know, there were a lot of things that I went through as a coach that I don't think my peers understood that I was going through. I just underestimated all of the administrative stuff that takes place outside of basketball. And when you get these jobs, your first inclination is, I want to get in. I want to get my kids situated. We're going to get better. I want to implement my system. And then you get an email and like, hey, coach, where are the kids going to be at for study hall? I'm like, you know, and then after that first year, though, you kind of cross your T's, dot your I's with everything. Administrators became a lot more supportive. It became more of a group effort with the parents. We're all looking out for each other. But that was the big underestimation, man. All of the logistics, all of the other administrative duties, you know, definitely went over my head at first.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. I think that as an assistant, you don't always get a feel for the amount of time that the head coach is spending on some of those things that are non-basketball related. It's a common theme that we hear when we ask that question. It's just, yeah, I didn't know that there was all these off-court non-basketball things that my head coach had previously dealt with. And man, now that I'm stepping up into this chair, I realize that there's a lot more to the job than just the basketball side of it. But talking about the basketball side, when you got the job, did you feel like you had a pretty good handle on sort of what your philosophy was in terms of how you wanted your teams to play? Or was that something that sort of developed over the first few years of you being the head coach? Obviously, you had some things in mind as an assistant. You get a chance to watch and learn and see what other coaches are doing. But when you take over that program yourself, how solid were you on your philosophy from the beginning? And when did you feel like you really had kind of pinned it down and got your teams doing what you really truly believed in?
The first year, it was just my identity. So I told the kids, I was like, I don't care how good you guys are or how bad you may be. It has to be me. I say, so because of my reputation, people remember me being smart. They remember me being tough, and they remember me being unselfish. So we're going to be those three things because that's going to be the expectation from one of my teams. Like, then the unselfish piece was like the biggest thing because I've always passed the ball. I love to pass the ball. So I have no way I'm coaching a selfish group. So once we got that implemented, I always wanted to play fast. I come from a pressure defense, man to man, full court running jump, background. Offensively, I like a good mix of, we can run some sets, but I also like to keep the floor spread with kids understanding to move, keep the weak side occupied on your own. Don't stand if you don't have the basketball, you know, create space for your teammates. I didn't want everything to come from the sideline, but I also wanted enough structure to help them get through some tough times. They couldn't do it on their own. But to answer your question, yeah, I had it, you know, back in my head, you know, how I wanted it to look. It took about 4 years for me to actually see it, to where we had some possessions during some games, or we had some stretches at the end of quarters where we would go on an 8-0 or a 12-0 run, and the other team was just gassed, and, you know, we were just blowing by them because we were just so much good condition. And, you know, I always wanted to be in a situation where I could sub. My junior college coach, we subbed 5 at a time. And the two groups would kind of compete against each other. Like, when you sub that first group, you know, that first group is telling the second group, hey, look, we're up by 10. Don't lose the lead. Don't blow the lead. It should go up to 20. So I created an environment where I was playing 10 kids consistently. And I always believed that I didn't want to keep a kid that I know this kid is not going to play for me. I wouldn't keep those kids around because it just ends up being salty towards the end of the season, or some type of gripe or bad feeling. So, you know, those last few years that I coached, we really had it rolling where I was playing 10, 11 kids consistently.
That's a huge point. It's one of the things that I learned really early on in my coaching career. I was an assistant varsity basketball coach at the school where I teach. And we had a kid, this is probably my first or second year coaching. We had a kid that we sat in the coach's office after maybe the second or third day of tryouts. And we said, are we going to keep this kid? And we brought the kid into the office and we talked to him and said, hey man, we like you. We're probably not going to have much room for you to be able to play, but we like you. You've been a part of the program. I think we're going to keep you around. And even though you're not going to play very much, and it ended up that we probably spent 60% of our time as coaches talking about this kid for the rest of the season and dealing with his parents and dealing with him and his attitude and this and that. And we sat down at the end of that season and we're like, we're never going to make that mistake again. That if there's a kid that we know is not going to play, even though, yeah, maybe sometimes it might work out that the kid's going to be fine, the reality is most of the time the kid's not going to be fine. And we just ended up from that point forward, just as you said, cutting those kids and not keeping them around, because inevitably, if they're not going to play, it ended up being more of a problem than it should have been. And you end up spending a lot more of your time on players who aren't really impacting whether you win or lose. I mean, they are, because they're infecting your locker room and doing other things that aren't good. But yeah, it's a good lesson to learn, especially early on in your career. And I think you make a good point about having your philosophy in place. And then as you start to build your program and you put together what you do in the summertime and guys start to be around you, and they're not only around when they're a junior or senior, but now they're kids that you've had that have come up through your system and they understand what it is that you expect. I think that's when you can really kind of get things rolling and you can really sort of take off and do what you need to do. How did you approach what you did in the summertime with your players, and maybe just lay out for people what the rules are like in Florida in terms of what you can and can't do, but just talk about how important it was for you to get guys doing things in the summertime in order to get your program where you want it to go.
So what I use the summertime for, summertime was for me to take the handcuffs off me that the kids may put on me. So you hear coaches say sometimes there's a phrase, you know, sometimes your kids can handcuff you with what you can't run because of what they can't remember. So I made the decision during the summertime, I would spend as much time as I needed to spend to put offenses in, to dry run, to go over and over and over and over whatever sets that I wanted to run, to give the kids ample enough times to rep it, to understand it, the drills. That way, when the season rolled around, we hit the ground running. Tried to find a good balance of playing, took more control of that. I think sometimes as a young coach, you feel a little anxious if you're not planning certain events, or, you know, kids are on Instagram saying that they're going here and your kids see that and say, hey coach, why are we going here? And it can make you feel a little insecure sometimes. So I, you know, put my hands around the program. We're going to do this. We're only going here. And the rest of this time is going to be skill development, conditioning, and we spent a lot of time dry running and executing our offense because I wanted to do a lot of complicated stuff. I wanted to be able to do what I wanted to do. I shouldn't say just complicated stuff. I wanted to run what I wanted to run. So because in certain situations, I believe that you have to be able to combat whatever's thrown at you on a defensive end. I never believed in the kids can't remember. I'm like, the kids can remember all of these songs. They can remember all of these CDs, all of these cheat codes to the video games. They can remember a play that has three phases to it if they want to. So, you know, I spent my summer times dedicated more so to the kids' growth and development, and as well as the stuff that would take a lot of time during the season. I didn't want to spend a lot of time during the season going over plays and kids learning stuff. There wasn't a lot of learning. I wanted to continue doing the growth, development, skill development, and practice. So, you know, our practices were split. The first 45 minutes was shootings, ball handling, you know, dribble moves, finishing at the rim. You know, we would split up kids at, you know, two to a basket, three to a basket, and we would do skill work for, you know, 45 to 50 minutes. I never believed in practicing long. We had a lot of 45 minute practices, hour and a half at the most, because of the way we play defense. I know it was taxing on my kid's body. So I was conscious of that. By the time late January rolled around, we're stretching, we're shooting, literally we're stretching, shooting, shooting, and getting out of there. So, and then we do film on the phone. You know, a lot of film work on the phone. All the kids had iPhones. So I would create folders. We did a lot of scout, you know, through the phone, through Zoom. So just have my own unique way of running that.
When you think about putting together a practice plan, what was your process for doing that? Are you sitting down at the computer by yourself? Are you talking to your staff? Are you using pen and paper? Just what's your process for putting together a plan?
So my process is initially for, so I felt like we have ongoing issues. So, and it may be, it may not be a team ongoing issue, maybe four kids that are struggling with a particular concept, whether it be offense or defense. So those things linger. So those are going to be things that we're probably going to touch every day. But from a planning standpoint, I'll sit down in the morning and thinking about next opponent, as well as those lingering things that, hey, no matter who we play going forward, we're going to have to tighten this up. I'm not happy with the rotation on this. I'm not happy with the ball movement on this. The rest of it is more of finding the balance between game planning and then just making sure I'm keeping it fresh for the kids to where they're not coming in practice saying, okay, well, we know what we're about to do today, to where they're getting bored. So I try to keep it fresh for them, and I try to make sure we're hitting some scout stuff and we're continuing to cover some stuff that I'm just not satisfied with how we're executing it, rather be on the offensive, defensive end.
When you look back on your time as a head coach at Paxson, if you had to point to one or maybe two things that you're most proud of about what you were able to accomplish, what are the things that come to mind?
Oh man, I made a big pool full of lemonade with two lemons. You know, I'm proud of what I was able to do with where I was. Paxson is, you know, known for high academics. It's not a neighborhood school. Kids don't go to Paxson for athletics solely. So I inherited a group of kids that were just at the school that they're at. There was not a lot of belief in basketball as far as what could be. I think district championships were far-fetched. I think Final Four appearances were far-fetched. We were local news darlings. We stayed on the news. You know, our kids got a lot of attention. And, you know, the thing that I'm most proud of is the light that I felt like I was able to help bring back to my old high school that was basically like a laughing stock when it came to basketball and the things that we were able to do and have my kids that played for me go off to play college basketball. And for me to coach a kid that won Florida's Mr. Basketball, you know, coming out of Paxson, you know, the respect that we have now as a program throughout the state of Florida, you know, it's one thing, one of the biggest things that, you know, stands out to me. Because when we first started traveling my first year, people were asking me where we were from. And by the time we were done, they wasn't asking anymore. It was like, there go Paxton.
Yeah, that's very cool. I mean, I think when you can establish that and get your name on the map and have people know that, hey, Paxton's here and they know what you're all about. And I think back to the three things that you talked about that sort of epitomized you as a player. When people can walk in a gym and know that those are the three things that they're going to see from you and your team as a coach, to me, I think that's something that, man, the pride that you have to have in that and being able to build that from nothing to the point where you didn't have keys to the gym in your first 2 years to you're getting to the point now where people kind of see you coming. And that's a tremendous accomplishment as a head coach. And yet you decide eventually that you're going to walk away from that. And now you got a new gig. So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now and what's exciting about that and why you decided to step away from coaching for at least the time being.
You know, I just felt like for stepping away from coaching, Mike, I just felt like my values and morals with basketball, it became too much of a struggle for me to get across to the kids. And I feel like it's their time. And though I feel like I have a lot to offer, I can offer a kid, a group of kids. When you have to butt heads with kids to get them to get somewhere that they say they want to go, it becomes frustrating and it's not fun anymore. So, you know, in my mind, I said, you know, I'm not too big to remove myself from the situation. You know, it's just one of those things where the time that I was dedicating and taking away from my family, and we did a lot of good stuff. I had a lot of fun, but it became to be a lot more grueling and a lot more frustrating than it was having fun. Because it's just the way the game is being played now, and you're having to say no to so many more shots now. You have to say no to a lot of kids who want to take pictures before the game. They want to have a videographer come to the game. And I'm like, God, you're on JV. Like, somebody's coming to video you. Like, how do you know you're going to get in? You know, so and when you push back, you can see the disappointment in the kid's face. Like, coach, I mean, so when I see that, I'm like, I didn't mean to hurt the kid's feeling, but you really, I'm like, dude, I could really, really, really play. Nobody was coming to video me. I'm like, if you're playing JV, you may not get in the game, and you all have hired a videographer to come. So it was those types of things that, you know, I just was like, you know, I don't want to. Maybe my time has passed. You know, maybe I'm the old guy. Maybe I'm, you know, Mick from Rocky or something like that. You know, maybe, you know, I just don't understand how it's done. So, you know, I decided to step away, and you know, I was luckily asked to do the color analysis at Jacksonville University, my alma mater. Last year I did some women's games, and then this year they asked me to do the women's and the men's game. So I'll tell you this, Mike, it is the hardest thing that I've done with basketball, because you know it, like, you know the game, but speaking it in a timely manner, in an efficient manner, in an articulate manner, sometimes it gets tough because you can't manufacture words or concepts. You have to speak what you're seeing. And sometimes you disagree, like, I'm trying to call the game and a guy takes a wild shot. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, how does he take that shot? Right. But I can't say that.
Right.
And it's like, I'm like, well, coach, what are we doing? Or why is he? No, don't put him in right now. Or why are we not throwing the ball in the post? Like, I have all these preconceived notions as a former coach and player. And at the same time, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm just supposed to be analyzing what I'm seeing and speaking about what I'm seeing and trying to enlighten the audience on what's going on or what kind of set that was, a floppy set or that was a veer or whatever the case may be. But I find myself getting caught up in what I think should be happening, which is not good, but it's fun though.
There's a lot of thinking on your feet, I'm sure. Anybody who's ever tried, and I know that I haven't done it in a long time, but I know there was a time where I'd put on a game and just try to commentate just for fun. And maybe even back in the days of a tape recorder. And man, it is hard to watch a game. And as you said, take in what you're seeing and then understand what it is that is going to be valuable to the audience as opposed to just what your thoughts and critiques are. I think it's a great point. For anybody who's ever tried it, it is extremely challenging. And I feel for you as you're doing it and you're kind of getting into it, and that at first it's got to be just a huge challenge as you're kind of going through it and trying to figure it out. And so as you've gone through and gotten to know sort of a little bit better of getting a feel for when you're talking, what you're saying, how you're saying it, what's been the most fun part of it for you? Like, what have you enjoyed the most as a part of just being around the team and yet not being responsible for it in the same way that you are when you're a coach?
You know, I think I get to enjoy the game itself. Like, when you're a coach, you're emotionally invested. You have something to win or lose. When you're a player, the same thing. You're invested. You have something to win or lose. But the perspective that I'm involved now, you know, I actually get to enjoy, you know, seeing a kid that I never heard of. And I'm like, oh man, this kid can play. Like, I could just sit and compliment the kid, and the style of play and the coaching of some of the coaches and the sets that are being run. You know, just I get to experience the admiration part of the game. It's not versus watching a game and saying, you know, well, how would I defend that? I would have defended that ball screen this way. I don't have to worry about that at all. I could just enjoy either the bad defense or the good defense, good offense and bad offense. Like, you know, I just enjoy it. And, you know, I think that's the point I've been waiting to get to actually try to be a fan of the game after being a student, you know, having to be a student for basically all of my life.
What's it been like being around the coaching staff and the kids? And I don't know how much access or how much time you're spending getting to know them on a personal level or getting to interact with them, but what's that been like for you when you have had an opportunity to sort of get to know the kids? And obviously you're not with them in the same way that you are when you're coaching, but I know that a lot of times guys, especially at the college level, when you're traveling with the team and doing that kind of, that you get an opportunity to really get to know those kids and sort of build that relationship with them.
You know, it's interesting because you try to take yourself back to when you were in that time. And you think about how you and your teammates were. So you're trying to figure out which guy was your teammate, like, right? Which guy was the jokester, you know, which guy is the quiet guy, which guy is the guy that, you know, is the crazy one or whatever the case may be. So I think that's been fun. I'm just trying to learn the different personalities and compare them to some of my old teammates. And then you also just, you're learning so much about how kids have changed in the sense of how they communicate. Whereas to, you know, I've been in practice after practice, me and my teammates may have been playing one-on-one or either just joking around or playing with each other, where all these guys are sitting around on their phone. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, like, we didn't have phones on the floor after practice. You know what I mean? They were in the locker room, and then we got them when we got to, there was no rush to hurry up and go get our phone and then get, you know, just come back around and sit around because we didn't have anywhere to go. So that part is different. The interaction that they have with each other was you know, interesting for me to see.
Yeah, absolutely. It's clearly completely different. Just like we talked about at the very top of the podcast, the difference of how kids grow up in the game in terms of AAU versus growing up on the playground. Obviously, that's a big change. And clearly, the locker room scene with phones versus no phones has changed a lot. And we know that our young people have grown up in a completely different era than the era we grew up in. And I see it with my own kids, and I see it with players that I've coached at various levels. It's just interesting how the dynamics have shifted. And now you're getting to see it on a completely different level from a different perspective. I want to wrap up, Toby, by asking you a final two-part question. Part one is, when you think about the next year or two and you kind of look ahead, and who knows if you're going to stay with this, or maybe at some point the coaching bug will jump back up and bite you. But when you think ahead, what is the biggest challenge that you have in front of you over the next year or two? And then the second part of the question is, what brings you the most joy about what you get to do each and every day now? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
My biggest challenge right now is actually trying to find something that gives me that rush, that of preparation, of competitiveness that coaching provided. It's just nothing like it. The anticipation of a game, preparing for your opponent, watching film, going to scout, being around your kids, making sure that they're prepared, making sure that they have what they need. It came with an unexplainable feeling that it came with. Trying to find something remotely close to that to keep me engaged in that way, I would say, is the search. And as far as joy, the biggest joy just right now is just being able to be with my wife more. Like, I didn't realize how much time we didn't spend together, not able to take trips between October and March because of the season. All that stuff you kind of take for granted. And now it's just like we kind of do what we want to do. You know, we want to go somewhere, we can. We want to go to dinner after work, we can. We want to sit around the house or we want to go work out. Like, it's just I've enjoyed the freedom of having that time back. And that's been bringing me the most joy. Just being able to have the family time, even with my extended family, my dad, my in-laws, just having them and having that time to spend with them.
That's well said. And I think it's something that all coaches think about and wonder about. And, you try to figure out ways to incorporate your family into what you do. But anybody who does it and does it well knows that it's a challenge to be able to find that balance. And when you finally step away from it, you realize, wow, there's a lot of time here that comes back to me. As you said, that it's good that you've been able to take advantage of that and spend that time with your family. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, whether you want to share social media, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
My email is Toby, T-O-B-Y, Frazier, F-R-A-Z-I-E-R, @gmail.com, and Twitter @Toby1Frazier.
Toby, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to jump on with us. Really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.